I come from a very funny family. I started business and I graduated and I majored in marketing. Comedy as a craft demands too much attention. Comedy is intimate. You talk to people, you make people laugh. People come with a lot of problems into these theaters. When we were starting comedy, we went to a lot of bars and we met the hostile audiences of people who don't want to listen to your English. There's a time they almost hit me with a bottle in some bar in Chibuye. And I would sometimes go on stages which I was not meant to. And then somebody is saying, Cheo geza cholo zungu. You know those things, like, why is he speaking English? But I don't perform in bars. However, corporate guys, It is. I believe in making errors at the start so that along the way, you don't make those mistakes when you grow. Art thrives on passion. It's like the first. Along the way, if you keep being on the passion and you're not earning anything from your craft, you start getting frustrated along the way. We have a lot of talent in the country as Uganda, but it's the platforms that are lacking. Maybe in the nearby future, we are going to be having comedy as the biggest export in entertainment. Mm-hmm. And I would be very happy to be a contributor to that,
AfroMillennial, the podcast, is a casual sound space for millennial creatives in Uganda and across the African continent to share their life stories. The podcast discusses a healthy balance of their professions, passions, and personal lives and offers a bit of perspective and lessons from their life experiences. Come on, let's have fun.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our pilot episode of season 2 of AfroMillennial, the podcast. My name is Anthony Michael Mwami, and I'm your host. And for our very first episode of the season, I'm going to be laughing a lot. And you'll find out why in a bit. I'll be laughing a lot because our very first guest for season 2 of AfroMillennial, the podcast, is a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
He's a stand-up comedian. He's a silent comedian.
Yeah,
he's not silent like Charlie Chaplin, but this time it's his how do you call it? That come to your show.
I don't know. I don't want to call them silent.
The congregation, the silent congregation.
I don't always call them the fans. I call them fam.
The fam.
My family.
Yeah. So he doesn't do silent comedy like Charlie Chaplin, but his fam listen to his comedy through the concept of silent comedy, which is something he'll be giving us a little bit of a bigger picture about.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to AfroMillennial, the podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Okello Okello.
Thank you so much. First of all, I am excited. This is my first time, and I'm also happy that I'm being on the first episode
of the podcast.
Of the podcast. So it is something beautiful. When you said the pilot episode, I've always wanted to be a pilot. Maybe this is this is an opportunity for me to enjoy that privilege. So I'm excited to be
but
here.
But also when the pilot is funny, that is not a very good thing. No one will take the precautions seriously.
He can change his mind mid-air. So I'm really excited and I am looking forward to this podcast.
Absolutely.
And we are going to have an amazing time.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to go and ask you who is Okello Okello.
Yeah.
But let me ask you, why Okello Okello? Because it feels a little bit like butter. Or border.
Okello Okello is a background basing on where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain period in time in my village whereby names were given to people basing on their skin color. So there was already this gentleman who was extra dark called Okello.
And I see where this is going.
The whole village knew him. He was like the champion of the color. And then I was born and I was twice darker than him. So they said, let's just give him Okello's name twice.
You're twice as dark.
So that's the Okello.
Hence Okello, Okello.
Exactly.
So you're Okello squared.
Okello
basically.
Squared, exactly. Some of my friends call me double black. So exactly. It's the same thing.
Does that present challenges when you have shows at night, the fact that you are no Okello, Okello?
Yeah, but my team works on lighting.
It's you make a lot of dark jokes.
It's a priority. I used to, but I stopped.
You stopped?
Yeah, I stopped.
I had this friend. There's a friend of mine called Emmy. He was at one of his parties during COVID.
Yeah.
And the task was for everyone present to make one dark joke, to give dark humor. And the man was caught off guard, impromptu. So what he did, he went to the switch
and
he turned it off and he said, humor.
No, that was a dark joke.
Hence dark humor.
That was a dark one.
You can keep that one if you want to, but I'll contact him on whether you have to.
You'll make me pay.
You'll have to pay for it. So. You'll have to pay for it. Which takes me now a little bit back to your creative process.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a few questions to try and understand your creative process of do you land on jokes the way I just gave you one, which you're going to have to pay for, or I'll get into that a little bit.
Yeah.
But before I get there,
I've
known you from a time before you went into comedy.
Yeah, sure.
At that point, I mean, to me, at least to myself, it didn't seem like something that you would be venturing into.
Yeah.
So now I'm curious, what happened along the way? Did an ex-girlfriend tell you, man, you know you're funny and those things? Did the village kids lie to you? He said, this is something I could make money out of. Like, how did your path end up veering into comedy?
First of all, I come from a very funny family.
Okay.
My father is...
Is that something the family knows or something people tell the family?
People tell me, like, your father is hilarious.
Yeah.
Even as we could see, my mom has a lot of stories and what.
Yeah.
But it is something that we just used to have as light moments at home. It was not a very big thing, you know. Then, but also growing up as a kid, I was a very quiet guy.
Yeah.
Even now, I'm a very quiet guy. I talk when I'm paid, but...
If it's not bringing money, it's not running your mouth.
So I'm a very quiet guy, but somehow I had that funny bone in me when I was amid these people. I'd say random things and people are laughing. To me, it looked normal.
Yeah.
But then to my friends, it looked like something exceptional, something that I could pursue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So until I think secondary, that is senior five. Yeah, senior five, that's when now there was a drama club in school and everything. But I would go and write my things.
This was the place where I met you?
Yeah, I would go and write my things. And then during drama time, I would ask the entertainment prefect to allow me talk to the students.
Yeah.
So I would have like 15 minutes there and I would talk to them. I recite what I'd written and guys would be laughing. And they're like, hey, man, you're funny. You're a funny guy. But then also I didn't think I would pursue it like more. Then I got done with university. Along there, I would MC when my friends have their functions, birthdays, whatever. I was like their first priority. No, this guy has to MC. This guy has to MC. Then they started giving me some little money, you know. I realized it's actually something I would pursue at a bigger stage. Then I contacted Omara Daniel, I think. Yes, Omara Daniel, those days it was the mic check and what.
Yeah.
Then he told me, no, you cannot just go on a big stage, but we have smaller stages that I can recommend that you can... You can start off with.
Yeah.
And I can tell you my first performance, my first ever test stage, we call it open mic, is the one that showed me that you can be a comedian.
Beautiful.
Yeah, because after doing open mic for 7 minutes and I walked off stage the next guys who came after me struggled. Because guys were like, we want the South Sudanese guy.
We want the Okello.
We want the South. Let him come back. Yeah. So I felt good. And also after the show, really, people came through. They tipped me. They said, man, you're very funny. You keep at this thing. So I started now putting in more effort. And that is where I ended.
Mad respect. That's a very rare occurrence. Yeah. I think for a lot of people that we've had on the podcast, their first shot at what they do. You know, went sideways. So for you to have had a very good first experience, I think I actually had a lot about your craft.
I actually had bad experiences. You know, it's art. But my first three
experiences
were the best.
Were mega.
So it made it even easier for me to accept the bad experiences, and I know that I am good. These ones are just maybe a bad day in office.
Same as everybody else.
Yeah.
Fast forward, you've been doing comedy here and there. You've done open mic and all these things.
Yeah.
How do you arrive at the concept of silent comedy? And what is silent comedy?
I'm going to start by maybe telling you what silent comedy is. Then I'll tell you how I arrive at it. Silent comedy is an incorporation of technology into comedy. Our real stand-up comedy. It's because comedy as a craft demands too much attention. And from my past experiences, I would go on stages and you're performing and people are on their phones. You know, sometimes, you know, when you're at the initial stages of your career, you make a lot of mistakes. And I would sometimes go on stages which I was not meant to. And then somebody is saying, "Cheo geza cholo zungu." You know those things, like, why is he speaking English for us? We expect the vernacular. What kind of that thing? So I realized that attention was not being given the way we needed. And then I realized comedy is intimate. You talk to people. You make people laugh. People come with a lot of problems into these theaters. So you talk to people. But how do we get the attention of these people? And then that is why I realized from my experiences of meetings whereby people have teleconferenced and everything, you realize that the headphones were actually vital. Then silent disco was already a big thing. And nobody had ever thought of, let me take this thing to comedy. Because also people go for silent disco expecting different channels.
So
me,
multiple channels, different music.
Exactly. Me, I decided to just dedicate one channel so that whether you're on your phone, you're still listening to the person on stage. So we just incorporated technology into comedy, and the results are amazing. It's amazing, both for the performer. The performers gain more. The audience also gain. But for the performer, it's the most, I think, it's the greatest innovation for any performer, because you need people to listen to you.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's the silent comedy thing. And how I got to it is, it was trial and error. I attended a number of events, silent
disco events.
Yeah. And I would ask those people, like, can this thing work in comedy? Can it? Then I have a friend in the UK, he works there, and he was telling me, we use headphones a lot for meetings. And you realize that the attention span is high. You need to try this thing in comedy. So I told him, we already have the headsets, because there is silent disco is a big thing. But I'll give it a try. I'll give it a try. And it could be the beginning or the end of my career, because I didn't know what.
It was a huge leap, true.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know how the public was going to react. So I didn't advertise it.
First silent comedy?
No, I didn't. Went, booked the headsets, I think around 400 headsets. I remember. 400 headsets. And then we sold tickets for a normal show to people. But the same night, there was another show which was happening at UMA. There was a big show which was happening at UMA. So it was like competition. And we didn't know. But somehow, my audience is very loyal. So when people arrived at the theater, everybody would reach, they would give them a headphone and they would ask, what is this one for? But I'd brief to the people at the address that tell them to just have it. So, but you see how we start our show with a guitarist and everything. So somehow people were wearing it, not knowing what is next. And then the theater just got full out of nowhere.
It filled out.
It filled like it sold out. I started, when I went on stage for my first session, people were sitting on the stairs at the National Theater, like space was done, headsets were done. And then now Richard Tuwanje, Fan Factory, took one photo that went viral. That was at around 8:30 p.m. When the photo went viral, even people were, some people from the other event,
started coming
crossed,
to it.
Yes, they crossed, even journalists. That
from
said,
Uma
yes, they
to
crossed,
the theater.
Yes, they crossed from the other side. Like, man, what's going on? And the thing really trended. I was happy. Also because of, I wasn't sure of the connections. I thought maybe it would be interrupted. It would maybe go off amid this, the show and everything. But I'd got a technician who really knows, he had been in that business for long. The transmitters, everything were just perfect. When the show ended, I could not explain what happened.
You couldn't believe what had just happened.
Exactly, I couldn't believe, because I remember I told another comedian, I was like, I'm going to do something crazy, but either this is going to be the end of my career,
or it's going to be a big thing
for my career, but I am going both ways, that if it fails, I went to school, I have a work experience, I'm going to apply for a job, I'll go back to former employment. So I was very relieved when I woke up the next day and yeah, it was like the thing. Yeah, that's how we got to silent comedy, and it now became like a household thing.
Concept,
yeah, it's a whole concept. I was doing it once, but the next time people were now sending us messages and saying, if it is the same thing that happened last time, am coming.
Yeah,
I am coming. So the audience grew like within a short period of time. Two shows the audience had shot, because my initial audience was, we started with an audience of 70 people. 70 people. Then that show was our most attended show.
Ever.
Not ever.
By then, it was your most attended show.
Because we got around 417 people.
Wow.
Then the numbers just shot. The next show, it just shot. Like, we went to a point whereby the full capacity of the theater would be sold before. If you follow my status, you would notice that I'll tell people that this percentage has already been, like, artwork and else. So it became really a big thing, and I'm happy.
I feel like all your first experiences have gone so well. I don't know if you have any like business lessons you'll be sharing with us, like when you've had hard times, but we'll get to those a little bit later. Just before we get there, question. So this silent comedy concept, was it pre-COVID or post-COVID?
It was pre-COVID.
It was pre-COVID.
Yeah. That was August, 2nd August 2018.
Ah, so by the time COVID came,
COVID just interrupted the excitement.
What was already
the experience,
happening.
Exactly. Yeah. After COVID, we just resumed, we just had to rebuild. But somehow that bat which was eaten spoiled a lot of things.
You're still convinced it was a bat?
I don't know. People eat a lot of things.
So I'm curious. There are other comedy specials than the silent comedy.
Yeah.
In terms of logistics, is that a little bit more expensive to put together because, you know, you have like dedicated listenership and things of a sort, or does it cost just as much?
Silent comedy is expensive.
It's more expensive.
It's very expensive because before that, my shows were a little bit financially friendly because it was just the normal basic expenditures, you know, theater, lights, stage and everything. But now
there's an added concept.
Exactly. And that is actually the most expensive.
More than lighting and all
those things. It's even more expensive than the venue because we sit huge numbers. Like the last show, we sat around 700 people. So 700 people, when you count all those headsets, it's a big expense. And also to know that it's a big expense. During COVID, one promoter called me and he said, I want to get permission to do your thing. And I told him, oh, which thing? It's like, I want to do silent comedy. And then he told me, what you do, just write for me the expenses that I should expect.
So when you say he wanted your permission to do
it. He wanted my permission to do it.
He wanted to replicate your concept
with
other people?
Yeah, he wanted to do it with other performers, but he wanted me to host it as well. Yeah. Because silent comedy is registered.
Yeah.
So he needed the permission.
Ah.
So when I wrote for him the expenditures he should expect, he didn't know that for all along we have been doing a very expensive show. So when he looked at the budget, immediately he called me and he said, my brother, your thing is nice, but I cannot do it.
I can't finance this.
It is expensive. And I don't know how you've managed to maintain it for a long period of time, but it is expensive. I've had several people who are also interested. I always willingly give them the permission.
Let them find out on their
exactly.
own.
Exactly. I always willingly give them the permission. So, yeah, it's an expensive thing.
Wow. Mm. So, there was a part where you mentioned the fact that, you know, you've been to stages where the audience is just wrong. It's not that you didn't do a good job. It's just the audience was not the one for you. In context of language, in context of perhaps the matter itself, the content itself.
Yeah.
How have you been able to gather these numbers without compromising your values in terms of language and in terms of, you know, there's like, there's different types of comedy.
Yeah.
And I think there's, you can agree with me, you could agree or disagree with me, but there's a very huge difference between the type of comedy that you guys do at National Theatre and the comedy that is, I think, at Comedy Store? Out there, we could say out there.
Yeah.
How have you been able to gather these crowds without compromising the values that you stand for as a comedian?
Okay. First of all, it also comes with your personal vision.
Yeah.
As a comedian, like everybody has an audience. Mm-hmm. Even the person who you are saying is vulgar is what they have an
they
audience
have their
that
audience.
Love.
Yeah.
Exactly that kind of comedy that they do.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest mistake that comedians make is thinking that you have to appeal to every
everyone.
Audience. And, I believe in making errors at the start so that along the way you don't make those mistakes when you grow. And we made a lot of these mistakes. For now, I would gladly tell people I don't perform in bars, however corporate guys it is.
Yeah.
Because when we were starting comedy, we went to a lot of bars and we met the hostile audiences of people who don't want to listen to your English.
Mm.
They just want somebody to wear a skirt or a gomesi, come and dance. And
be a jester.
Exactly. That's the kind of comedy they wanted. So, but we made mistakes and it also made us to be stronger people. There's a time they almost hit me with a bottle in some bar in Chibuye. Actually, that was the point I decided that I don't think I need
this
to perform
it.
In bars anymore.
Yeah.
But I would go there. But my type of comedy is the one whereby you can have your parent, you can have your children, you sit, you enjoy, you watch.
Yeah.
It's not for the bar. You also need to follow me. You need to listen because I won't shout, but I'll give you a good story if you follow.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that is exactly how it is. And it's how I decided that I need to create a niche of my own.
Yeah.
I need an audience that will love what I do. If you noticed, I do not have other people on my artwork because I always believe that people should come for comedy, not for faces of people. The day you start advertising faces, people start judging. The next show they'll say, so who are you bringing? Yet we have young kids who are extremely talented, who if you put on the poster, they may not attract two people, but they can do a great job. So I then decided to just work on that niche. And also, content is key. So our form of marketing, we look for people we believe love actual content.
Yeah.
Yeah, if our audience is like 95% of people who value content, no matter who presents the content to them. So, and we also make sure every show we give them content that is worth the time. Because almost all the people who come for my shows don't go for other shows within the week, within the month.
I mean, I'm one of them. I won't lie. I've been to it.
They come for one show and then they'll ask you when is the next one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we value content and we make sure that the content brings back the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like you have a very, very clear picture of who your target audience is and you channel your marketing towards these people.
Yeah.
That's great. Mm. Okay. Now take us a little bit into now we arrive at your creative process. How do you, like, as Okello, how do you arrive at your, do you dedicate time to sit down and say, now let me think up jokes, or is that a little bit, is that too programmed? Do they just come to you as and when?
First of all, I believe that if we overthink jokes, they don't turn out to be as good as the random thoughts. But also, like any other job, you become good at certain things. Things just happen to you along the way, depending on how long you've taken. An accountant will know what to do exactly if the books are not balancing. You say there is something wrong on the debit side, there is something wrong on the credit side.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with a comedian. When you stay in it longer, ideas start randomly coming to you, like conversations I have with people on a daily, the people I meet, the people I talk to, the people I interact with, the people I work with, the spaces I work in. But I note down every random funny idea that comes to me. I note it down.
You have like a notebook somewhere?
I
carry your phone.
I note it down. Then from Monday to Friday, I wake up at 5:30 or 6 to 7.
You're an early riser.
From Monday to Friday, I wake up within that period of time, and then I do structuring of the funny ideas now. Because funny ideas just come in form of punchlines. You have to get a body for that story. So that is now when I can write
So you build up.
I build up. But also, occasionally along the way, I meet comedians. We have a comedy clinic with other young comics. So along the way, we always also go there and then we start sharing ideas. And like, I got this idea, I structured it this way. And then you go through with them and you say, what do you think? Then maybe somebody adds something to you and says, no, I think it would sound better this way. Then it would sound better this way. Then we practice, because we don't want to bring extremely new stuff. We practice, we have an open mic, like every Monday, we go and practice on Monday. And then after trying that joke, you get again different angles to the same joke. Then you go back home and restructure it again, depending on the reception from the audience, because the audience for testing material is almost comedians only. Yeah, so when we do the testing, we can now go on stage. And then you put it on stage. Of course, it's like every joke is like 60% complete until you stand with it on stage. And then you get, there are also random ideas that come on stage, instant ideas, improv, that add on.
Do those come to you a lot?
Yeah, they do. They do. Actually, over the years, when I started hosting my own show, initially I was so script-oriented. But when I started hosting my own show, 40 or 50% of the content you get on stage.
Wow.
Maybe I've just seen somebody there. Somebody has said something.
So it comes from the crowd.
Exactly. So, but it also comes with the time you have taken.
Yeah.
Initially, most people are structured comedians. You have a script, you have this and this and this. That's why you see sometimes when you're in the middle of your set and somebody says something, you can freeze.
Yeah, you laugh at all those things. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So that is the impact of the experience that comes.
Beautiful. You guys have this peer-to-peer review thing that you do as comedians. You actually like listen to each other's jokes and say, that one passes, that one won't pass. Like you just said, you said you guys test it.
We listen to, but we don't, we have a saying in comedy, we say there is no bad joke. So all jokes pass. all the jokes pass, but we just find a better angle for it. So we do that.
So
yeah.
You retouch.
Yeah, we retouch it
as opposed to discarding.
Exactly,
them
we do that. I've never discarded a joke because I know there is somebody who has a better idea for that joke. Also, there are jokes that are not meant for you. You get a funny idea, but you know this one is not mine. So you can meet somebody who fits in that, then you give it to them.
So these peer-to-peer reviews, are they do they have some of the big shots and then some of the new guys, or is it more like, are there access levels to this thing that when you get to a certain level, then you gain access to, you know, certain people critiquing your content? Or is it more like the newbies and the big guys all in one big space?
The comedy industry is very open. So I don't feel there are restrictions, but it is also with the rapport you create with people.
With the other guys.
Yeah, it is easy for you to access, because me right now, I talk to almost every comedian.
Yeah.
So it is easy for me to meet Napoleon, to meet Salvador, and I say, I have this joke.
Yeah.
Let me go through. What can you add for me? Then he will add it for you.
Yeah.
But we have a more consistent structure. That is the Comedy Clinic. And we have majorly the young, the growing comics. They meet more often because, just like in any other part of the world, people tend to have cliques depending on the certain period of time where they joined that thing. So we have...
So it's like generational
It's a generational kind of thing. Yeah, but we do have... But at the Comedy Clinic where we test the content from, we have had big shots come through. Anne Kansime, I've seen her several times at the open mic. I've seen Omara Daniel several times, Cotilda Inapo, I think Mukebete. So it's by luck that maybe it's a night you're going to do your joke and then a big shot is there. It would be a good day for you. But besides that, there is a lot of work you have to do. It also comes down to the passion you have for what you do. If you want to be better at what you do, you can sacrifice. I'll say, this week I am going to look for Timothy Nyanzi. No matter how busy I am, I have to look for him. So you create an appointment, you go and meet him, you say, I have these ideas I wanted to go through. So it also comes to what you put in and how much you want to achieve. So, but the comedy industry is very open.
Brilliant. You've obviously picked up quite some lessons on commercializing your craft along the way.
Yeah.
I mean, you started from your high school stage. You gained connections with the people that you needed to gain connections with to start commercializing your craft. What are some of those lessons you've picked up along the way that you think upcoming comedians need to know about that bridge between just being funny and being funny for money?
For you. Depends on their aspirations. Nobody wants to be poor, first of all. But also for art, to be specific, most, be it music, be it comedy, art thrives on passion. It's like the first. It's like the first. But along the way, if you keep being on the passion and you're not earning anything from your craft, you start getting frustrated along the way. Personally, maybe it has come a little bit easier for me because I studied business. I studied business and I graduated and I majored in marketing.
So the whole, you have the whole business element of your craft figured out.
In every, not only the craft, in everything I do. I feel there should be business involved because everything needs business, you know.
You're a sports guy as well,
I am.
You're making money there as well.
I know. The lessons that I picked along the way from the young comics to the young comics is that, first of all, you do not reap from where you don't invest. That is actually the first step to making money, to earning from whatever you're doing. You need to invest. And it takes me back to the first question of you putting an extra effort if you want to earn from. So it's the same thing if you want to earn as well. You want to be hired to go to serious shows, but your dress code is not nice, you know. Somebody saying, I like him, he's funny, but
can't present him.
I cannot present. He's not presentable. So that is like one. Then two, also how you work with people.
Yeah.
Do you give them value for money? Because everybody gets a shot in life. You get that one shot that is going to open doors for you. But when you get that shot, did you give value for it? Did you value that opportunity that you got? Like if somebody called me and said, I want you to come and perform at Africa Laughs. Did you build the content that fits? Did you work hard enough? Do you look great? Is your presentation worth it? You know, so it is something that I feel the young comics should take like very serious. And when you take it serious, also your association, wealth is association with people. Your relationship with people is also another phase of wealth. How do you work with people? You see, entertainers, we tend to be overly excited. God can bless you one day and you get one big gig, you make money, you buy your kaka and you start splashing mad on people because you've got it. But then there is that one person who is going to still keep walking to his street and is talking to his guys who have seen him from day one. So those recommendations are very important. Because somebody will say, ah, me, I've known Okello for long and he has not changed. He's the same guy. So it makes it easier for people to support your venture if you're a people's person, if your relationship with people is great. And that is also another thing that makes you get money.
Yeah.
It is wealth. Relationship
your
is
social
wealth.
Capital.
Uh-huh, social capital, exactly.
It's crazy that I asked you that question as advice for younger comics, but it directly spoke to a current situation I'm in with my producer.
Okay.
We are working together on a task and I've been feeling like we are giving it, you know, 200%.
Yeah.
This is, you know, if it's your first shot at something,
throw
in everything, then what comes thereafter, you know, just sort of works into it.
It's also because first times don't usually yield. And your persistence.
Well, that's something I didn't take into account.
But
now you and my producer seem to be siding against me.
No, the first time things usually don't yield.
Yeah.
And also it's your perseverance.
Yeah.
That is also another rule to wealth. If you keep doing the same, you cannot keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah.
So if you're persistent in what you do, eventually it pays off.
True.
Yeah.
True. It's crazy. You mentioned friends and you mentioned your friendships, your relationships and their role in growing your career. And it's funny because it was my very next question here in my script. Because if there's one thing I've noticed about your comedy shows, which is a bit different from other comedy shows I've attended, is that you seem to have an interpersonal relationship with a lot of the people in your audience.
Yeah.
Or it's something you build up towards over time. And speaking about an audience that has gathered as many as 700 people at some point, I feel like that is quite something that you've really, really invested into. And it's notable. It's noble.
Yeah.
I just wonder if, does it ever get to a point where it starts to emotionally drain you? Like, do you feel like you have to treat each of them specially, or are there people that understand that, you know, it's part of the craft and it's demanding in that sense? And he's being professional. He's not like really trying to be there as well.
First of all, I think that's actually a very good observation, because I know if a show attendance is 500 people, just know I know 400. Personally,
I've noticed that.
Yeah.
I've noticed that.
So, it is something that I've built over time, but it's also been a very good trait that I've had as a person my whole life, that I have friends who are 20 years old, friends from as far as 2003, friends from as far as 2001.
Yeah.
I am very good at maintaining friends. So, it has made it very easy for me to have this thing going on.
This rapport with them.
Exactly. Because I've reached a point whereby when I have a show, somebody says, my MD has never attended a comedy show in Uganda, but if you come to the company and physically. I'll talk to him to make sure he can. So they are helping me because of the friendship. And then I'm building new audiences through the friendship that we have created. But the emotional bit of it, it does. Occasionally there are those moments whereby people feel, there are some people who feel they could have deserved more, you know, from you, but then they forget that there is the other professional bit whereby you are also like a normal person, you're busy.
So is it like a bit of entitlement?
Yeah, somehow there are those people who feel like, but they, it's really not very many.
Yeah.
It's if I'm to put it in terms of percentage, it's like 2%.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like 2%. But it is understandable also from them because human beings in nature, we are always expectant.
We like that. Yeah, we like that connection.
Exactly. Okay. So, but it is not something I really worry about so much. Yeah.
Okay. So you said something about the fact that, you know, you've kept this circle of friends over the years because you've not really changed. Like you've stayed authentic to yourself and it has. But your career is growing.
Yeah.
And as it keeps, I mean, you're already doing tours, you know, cross-country tours and all these other places.
Yeah.
So I think change is inevitable for you in the sense that you'll get to a point where you become a little bit inaccessible or a little bit harder to reach for the people that, you know, had a certain level of access to you before.
Yeah.
And I think it's natural for any creative that is growing. You know, they get to a point where as they grow, change occurs to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people adapt with that change and then some people sort of stay back and things of that sort. So do you think it is something that creatives can mentally prepare their friends for? Because I know there are those friends who become proud of the change that is occurring to you.
Yeah.
And then there are those friends that take it personally.
Mm.
In the sense that, he's not who I used to know and those things.
Mm.
How do we get our friends to appreciate the fact that I'm changing is not bad? Mm. It's a good thing for me and for you in a sense.
I think change is a good thing that everybody who wishes you well should appreciate. But depends on the change. Depends on the change.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is negative change, which is notable.
Yeah.
You know, which is sometimes very notable that even you can know. And with negative change, there is pride involved. There's a lot involved within the negative. But with positive change, you don't even know, by the way. In most cases, things just keep happening.
Yeah.
Things just keep happening. But I think we can also mentally prepare people. I chat with a lot of people on a daily. It's because I said, if there is any change which is ever going to be in my career, it should be physical, it should be brand-wise, but should never be in terms of communication. And I make sure my communication is key. Even in relationships, you know, it's very important. So I make sure my communication is perfect. I respond to almost everybody. Even if I forgot, but I realize like after some days, I would still respond to you and I explain why. Sorry, I've maybe been on set, I've been shooting this, I've been busy, I missed this message, but you get. Yeah, so communication is important. My status is viewed by a lot of people, but whoever responds to a status, I respond back to them.
So I can attest to that at least.
Yeah, so I make sure that the communication shouldn't be part of the changes that I have. But if there is growth, if tomorrow you woke up and I had bought a helicopter, that one I can't change because maybe I've got it, you know.
Yeah.
I will have to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not cut myself away from society. There is a time I got an event whereby I was supposed to have a security team. And then after the event, we went to hang out and then there is a security guy around and then I meet my friends. And people are excited to meet you, you know, but every time they would come, they would stop them. No, you can't access this booth. I just had to go and talk to the security guy, like, you know what? You see, I know these guys. You sit, let people come through. And the guy said, I can't sit. I said, okay, you stand, but just be easier to the guys. Really, I don't lose anything. Sometimes. Yeah. So cutting access is a bad thing.
Yeah.
That is why you see sometimes people get mad at their favorite entertainers. They just want to maybe say hi to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think cutting ties, communication, it is something which is good. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. Mm. How do you create sustainability in the comedy industry in the sense that how do you put yourself in a place where, as a comedian, you're thriving or your livelihood is assured? Does that look like, I know for a fact that your show has sponsors.
Yeah.
So is that in a sense that you sign long-standing contracts with sponsors in the sense that they will keep you running? Or is that more like staying up every night thinking of content, show after show after show? Because that was one thing that I think Navio and a few other creatives shared when COVID was just starting out. They said, you see the difference between Ugandan entertainers and American entertainers is that those American entertainers will do one tour a year and it will feed them for like the next 3 years. Whereas for us Ugandan entertainers, in one night you have like four or five stages to go to to be just to be able to get by. So how have you established that sustainability for yourself in this sector? What does that look like?
First of all, is invention. Constant innovation is very important to make you relevant. It brings relevance.
Yeah.
I think in my entire life, the only thing that has not changed along the way is the shape of a chapati. But
you still love your chapati.
But I would happily buy a chapati if it came square.
I don't think I'll ever stop eating the Rolex. I've told people multiple times, no matter how rich I grow,
exactly,
Rolex stays with me.
But now you see there are changes with the Rolexes. Initially, it was just
a plain Rolex. And now there's chicken pieces.
There's pineapples
in there.
Exactly. So it is those small changes are very important.
Yeah.
They are very vital that if you keep having them come through, because I'll be very honest with you, most of my sponsors are not long term.
Okay.
Most of my sponsors come back. It is like per show.
Ah.
But now, because we have been also giving them a run for their money, the innovation, so you realize that they would just automatically come
back.
Exactly. We have not yet got a long term sponsor apart from one two who have stayed with us now for, this is the second year running. But the rest of them, they come per show. So the more you keep creating and also throwing new things along here and there, it always keeps people on their toes. And also people want to go with relevance. The day you stop being relevant, it's the day that people, even your best friends, will stop associating. Funny thing is that one of my first friends who came for my show came for the show because he knew me. I actually had to save that message on my email up to now.
I came to your show because I knew you.
Exactly. He sent me a message the next day and he said, bro, I've never known you as a funny person, but I came because I know you.
Yeah.
But I want to assure you that from today onwards, I am your fan. It is just beyond the friendship. You've given me something that almost the entire industry had not given me for long. I'd stopped watching comedy like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that value is important.
Mm.
You always make sure you add something little. You also make sure you're serious. It's a craft. It's something you want to have as your career. So if you're not serious about it, then it does not make sense.
Yeah.
The innovations and everything now, like the sign language thing last time, I was amazed. But it is also something that we just said, we need something new. What other reason do we need? Which other part of the society has been ignored?
So you stay on your feet.
Exactly. Which part of the society have we ignored that we need to have in the show? And I told my manager, I told him, there is the deaf people. We could cater for them. Mm. You know, we can cater for them. But does it work? So why can't we test the depth of water with both feet? If it fails, if it works, then we brought a sign language interpreter and then we advertised the show among the deaf, around 40. They came through and after the show they said their entire livelihood, that was their best experience because nobody has ever invited them for entertainment.
Wow.
And they have never enjoyed a night like that. So it is such small things because now that audience has also, we have also now tapped on that audience, you know? And there are many people who are deaf. They have their money, they want to enjoy, but where should we go to without where we are going to be included? So it's those small additions, innovations that I feel creates the sustainability. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Beautiful. I think that's quite moving. Anything that, you know, we are coming more and more into times that are calling for us to recognize the diversity of who we are as people and to try and be inclusive as possible. So yeah. I think the fact that your strategy on sustainability looks towards, you know, just bringing in more and more people from all other walks of life, I think it's amazing. I personally have not heard of a comedy show that had a sign language translator. So
it was nice. Thank you.
I'm sorry I missed that one, but it must have been exciting. So how did that work? Was the translator, like, besides the comedian on the stage?
Yeah, the interpreter was at the side of the stage.
With a light on them?
No, we needed a bright light
and
then a good background, which we created prior to the show.
Yeah.
And also we brought, we reserved the front seats for the deaf community so that they can have a clear view, a clear vision. Yeah, but the interpreter was by the side of the stage.
Beautiful. As I wind up with you, Okello, one profound thing that you mentioned about the uniqueness of your show is that you have a whole lineup of comedians every single show, but the artwork only displays you as the entertainer of the show.
Yeah.
And I think that works in your favor because it leaves people in that space where they don't know what to anticipate.
Exactly.
And I've been lucky enough in the sense that the times I've been to your show, actually at least two names of the people that show up on that stage blow my mind. Like, okay, and the money I was paying for, I didn't know this person was going to come and present. I mean, I think there was a time, was it Pablo?
That was must have been Pablo, yes.
There was a time Pablo showed up on stage and I know him through other circles, but I was pleasantly surprised. Like, he just showed up. Then at some point, Napoleon.
Yeah.
Then Cotilda, I think, has also been to a couple of those.
Yeah.
I think it's really amazing that, you know, like you said, sometimes you have these shows going on and you have these big shots and then you don't display them.
Yeah.
I think it leaves you in a place where people are able to anticipate.
Exactly.
And to keep expecting. And then this other unique concept of you have people that are also not comedians coming in, you know, some musicians, some
poets,
violinists, poets, and people of the sort. I think that's a whole creative concept. Now that brings me to my last question. What does the show look like moving forward? You don't have to give away the whole chunk of it because you know, we have the other people, competition.
I don't fear competition. Competition is good. City of danger. Competition is good,
So what does the show look like, you know, two, three shows from now?
First of all, we always create like a plan for the whole year.
Okay.
That has been like one of the biggest strengths of our show.
Yeah.
Even on the socials, you realize I shared an artwork that had all the dates for the year.
Okay.
That is, first of all, a strength. It's a good one.
I think it communicates the fact that you are well structured and you have everything in position.
So, but at the beginning, after lockdown, our target was to first bring back the people to the theater, which we successfully did. I think we did 5 shows, but from the very first show, people actually came back. It's like they were just waiting for the whole 2 years for when are these guys resuming. So that was the target. Then along the way, we decided that this audience must grow bigger than this. This audience must grow bigger than this. And then we now had to go move to a bigger theater along the way. and it has also worked. But the next 3 or 4 shows now is our basic plan is we have had very many people from those other cities across the country asking, like, when I bring the same experience you people have in Kampala to our city.
Yeah.
So we are going to be having like a whole lot of a country tour of taking silent comedy to the different, actually starting with Jinja is the first city after Kampala that is going to be having the experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the plan is we want to have it as we want first three, next three shows, we want it to move around the country. Then also we want to see some other young comedians who step on this stage, like shoot up. I've seen some of them shoot up, but I want to see more of these young comics shoot up, because you see that we have a lot of talent in the country as Uganda, but it's the platforms that are lacking. So if my platform is in position to make somebody get noticed somewhere, I would, that is my pride.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and we are really focusing on that. If you've noticed, our performers list is always having young comics more, because we focus more on the young comedians.
And I've noticed that you carry them from all corners of the country.
Exactly, yeah. We just want everybody to feel, because initially people would say, you people just select each other because you're in Kampala. No, we want to bring like different kinds of people from up country, from everywhere. So that gives it that feeling that maybe in the nearby future, we are going to be having comedy as the biggest export. In entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be very happy to be a contributor to that, yeah.
Before we go, you mentioned all these plans.
Mm.
Is there juicy media engagement anywhere within your plans, in the sense of, you know, TV or social media, so things like YouTube? I know some of your comedians are now throwing skits on TikTok and all those other places. Mm. Are there any other places that you see yourself?
Yeah, we have been trying to engage TVs. It's even not the first time from the very word go.
Mm.
We have been trying to engage TV, but also I think our TVs still don't know that content is very expensive. and that has been the biggest challenge.
Yeah,
I'll give you a reference of South Africa. They are like the best in comedy.
Yeah.
And they're earning really big from it because they value content. So as a person who is running a platform and recording content from other comedians, for now, the best I can do is to cut the content and give it to them. It wouldn't, unless they permit me to, because I feel we still don't have the finances to have this content of somebody else
running.
On a TV channel, and then you cannot give it. May make me more famous, more popular.
But that's not what you're chasing
exactly
at this point.
Because along the way, you will be famous, but the people will start hating you. Say, this guy used us, you know, he exploited us, he did this. So I don't want it to go that angle.
Because your comedy involves other people in there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My personal content is going to go online, I think, in 2 weeks from now, because we have all that content.
This podcast is in good timing.
Yeah. So,
so 2 weeks from now, you'll be on TV.
Yeah. No, on YouTube.
On YouTube.
We are now going to start having my content
online.
Yeah, yeah. And then maybe a little bit. TikTok is picking up so fast. So that's where I see in the next month.
Super.
Yeah.
Super. We're really excited. I can't wait to hear about that.
Thank you.
And maybe just before you go, could you, I know you said you shared the dates on social media.
Yeah.
Firstly, could you just give us a rough picture of what the dates look like, so listeners know, you know, listeners in which part of Uganda should be braced for the show at what point? And then also maybe you can just take us through what socials we can check out to see these dates at a later point.
Okay. The first date we had actually was the grand opening, which was at Theatre La Bonita. That was on 3rd of March. And then our second show is on Friday. The show is called The Comedy Black Friday, though most people now call it silent comedy. Yeah, but the show is called The Comedy Black Friday. The next one is on Friday, 5th of May.
Okay.
And then the next one will be on Friday, 7th of July. Then the next one is on Friday, 29th of September. And then the grand finale of the year is on the 1st of December, 2023. That is Kampala shows.
Those are Kampala dates.
Yeah, Kampala dates. Upcountry, I don't think I have most of them.
Okay.
But Jinja is happening on the 8th of on the 8th of April.
Okay.
Saturday. And then Lira Independence Day. That is 9th of October. That is Lira. This I remember Lira because that is my home.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes then sense. I'm glad you remember Jinja because that is my home.
No, Jinja is also my other home. Jinja is also my other home. I've been raised up by Uganda entirely. That explains why I speak more than five languages, actually.
Yeah.
Then on the social media, as a person, it's at Okello Kello on... no space in between the Okellos.
Yeah.
On Instagram, on Twitter, and then on Facebook, it is Okello, then space, Okello. It's a page, not the account.
Yeah.
Then on Twitter, the comedy at Comedy Friday. Then on Facebook, it's the Comedy Black Friday. That's where you can get us.
Beautiful. Mm. I realize I keep saying last question, but I keep like getting...
No problem. We have the entire afternoon.
Okay. But once again, thank you so much for bracing this afternoon to come and join us on AfriMilenio, the podcast.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're like a huge... I mean, you're a huge success. You're a huge inspiration. The fact that you basically trailblazed a concept that has not been... successfully explored by anybody else. I think that goes to say a lot about your commitment, a lot about your time and devotion into the concept. And I hope it's turning out great for you, and I wish nothing but the absolute best for you.
Thank you.
So I'm sure that there's all these young comics that look up to you. Do you have comics that you look up to?
Internationally, locally?
Both.
Both, yeah. My inspiration internationally was... and this I'm speaking from experience, was a gentleman called Clint the Drunk. And then up next there is Basket Mouth. And I'm mentioning those two because at the initial stages of my comedy when I was still in school, I used to copy a lot of their work and paste, copy and paste, copy and paste. So they were like my first inspiration, you know,
They were a literal inspiration for your work.
Exactly. So I hold them in high esteem.
Yeah.
But also along there, Dave Chappelle does it for me. Then locally, but the international stars, I have Omara Daniel. That gentleman is intelligent. It intrigues me when I'm watching him. I watch him to learn. Then Salvador is also done great for himself and his country. So those are the people I look up to. There are quite many. There is what's his name? Napoleon Emma.
Yeah.
He's also a great inspiration, especially when it comes to content. I watch him in admiration. He's a very funny guy. Yeah, so then Timothy Nyanzi. I do not talk comedy and I forget that guy. And my inspiration comes from a personal interaction that I have with him and his passion for grooming young talent. So I can never have any interview, I can never have any podcast, and you don't hear that name.
I feel like we should secure Timothy Nyanzi.
Yeah, sure, you need
to. I feel like we should secure Timothy. But that's a conversation we'll have internally after you leave. Thank you so much, Okello.
Okello.
Listeners, thank you for taking the time to listen to AfriMilenio, the podcast. We are back with a bang. We are back with a lot of exciting and inspiring stories about the creatives. If you have any cliff notes, if you have any thoughts on what Okello shared with us here, please feel free to reach out to us on 0709-970-970 and share with us your feedback via WhatsApp. Don't forget to check out Okello across all platforms. And when you're done with that, check out AfriMilenio as well across all social platforms. Leave a like, leave... you know, comments, make a share, maybe something you'd like to say to Okello without saying to him directly, please use us, we shall reach him.
Actually, on the same number, also mobile money, you can always send mobile money.
If you have mobile money for Okello, please send it on that same number. I can't promise that it will reach him, but I can promise that I'll acknowledge that.
I will always notice. When money is sent, I notice. I talk to money, I know.
Thank you, listeners. Until 2 weeks from now is when we'll be having our next episode. Cheers. Thank you.